So every spring, I have the great privilege of teaching an honors colloquium at Providence College on Faith and Science. And one of the most of my 15 students are graduating seniors in all of the biological sciences. So it's a really, really cool class to teach. And we spend the first lecture talking about why a scientist would want to study philosophy or theology. Now, for this particular class, they want to get into that because the previous Christmas, the Christmas before the class, they read Dawkins. And they want to be able to respond to Dawkins. And so we do St. Thomas. But at the end of the day, one of the things I want to impress upon them is that scientists do philosophy and theology for the same reason we do science. And that is,
it's the first sentence of Aristotle's Metaphysics, all men by nature desire to know.
And physicists especially, they want to go after a grand unified theory of everything, but that still remains a grand unified theory in the scientific mode. But it is philosophy and theology that allows you to have an incredibly encompassing worldview, the worldview we call wisdom. Now, I'm going to invite you into my personal journey and search for wisdom. And this lecture is, in many ways, it will help me to trace my intellectual journey. So, as Father Bonaventure pointed out, I started at the University of Pennsylvania with bioengineering, and then I went to MIT to do my PhD in biology. And I entered the Dominican Order to do philosophy and theology. Well, I entered the Dominican Order because the Lord asked me to. But at the end of the day, my brothers introduced me to philosophy and theology. And Father Michael Dodds is back there. And when I was a first-year philosophy student, a month after vows, we went out to California to do philosophy. And he was the one who introduced me to St. Thomas's philosophy of nature. And I have to tell you that me being a typical scientist, thinking that scientists know it all, I entered that class wondering why I even bothered to do philosophy. And he, in an incredibly beautiful way, began to show me that philosophy is about making theories in the same way that science is about making theories. But the theories that philosophers make, especially and theologians, it's a theory involving everything. And so for the past 20 years, I've been doing Thomas as well. And one of the things that I want to impress, the reason why my students will ask, why Thomas, not Descartes or Kant or someone else? It has incredible explanatory power. And so this is a project that a couple of my brothers and I have been doing to mysticevolution.org, which is an attempt to bring St. Thomas into conversation with evolutionary theory. But at the end of the day, Thomas's intellectual synthesis even explains angels. And no God could ever do that. No grand unified theory would ever be able to do that. And most profoundly, it's not just about what is going on in the world, it's also about how we are to seek what fulfills us most in that world. Which is why, in my view, Thomas is cool. And I'm here today to introduce you to, for most of you may not have had much Thomas, to the conversation between Darwin and Aquinas. And my lecture is going to focus on this. How do we bring the insights of evolutionary theory into conversation with this 800-year-old Thomistic intellectual synthesis? How do we reconcile the evolution of snakes with Adam, Eve, the fall, and the eschaton? That's really kind of like the Dominican Project. And my contribution is just a little bit of that, talking about how evolution will help us to understand that better. So the lecture this morning is going to be divided into four parts. I'm going to begin with evolutionary theory, only because I wasn't sure who was going to be in the audience. So I'm going to start with evolution, what do we know about evolution, and what is the evidence for the evolutionary account of the world? Then I'm going to talk about three things: causality after Darwin, human nature after Darwin, and virtue after Darwin. My doctorate in theology is in morals. So what I want to do is I want to recover natural law, because there are a lot of issues with the contemporary account of natural law from a Thomistic perspective precisely because of Darwin's view of the world. And so, in many ways, all of this is going to lead to how are we going to be happy in an evolving world. That's really what hopefully I'll be able to do. Today I won't be able to do that, but I'm going to focus in on some of the trajectories of some of the things that I've been thinking about. So I'm going to begin with evolutionary theory. And this is from my introduction to biology class. I love teaching Bio 103, which is the introduction freshman biology class at Providence College to our majors. We have 50 to 100 in my class every semester, depending upon the particular semester that we happen to be teaching in. And so we teach evolution, and there are two claims that evolutionary theory makes. Universal common descent, that means every living thing is descended from an original primordial living thing. And that this happened through a process of modification where natural selection was working with genetic variation. And so this is the theory. Now, my students and I go to meetings, science meetings, we go to the AAAS, we go to the AACR. These are all different professional meetings. And it's really striking that my research students forget that their PI, that's their professor, is a priest. So we end up going to these meetings, and they often get asked the question, why are you hanging out with a Catholic priest? And they will always say, well, it's because he's our PI. And the very first question they get is, does he believe in evolution? It's always the case. And they'll say, oh, sure. And then they'll ask, why? Why does he believe in evolution? And I've taught my students to say, because the data is really good. So what I would like to do is to give you, in summary form, the account for why I think that evolutionary theory is the most robust account for how God creates through this process. So, to distinguish special evolution from evolutionary theory, with special creation, the most simplistic account is that every single species begins at a particular point in time, and there is no change over historical time. In contrast, the evolutionary account talks about a primordial organism out of which different kinds of beings evolve. And so, for example, you have the primordial fish, and today we have descended from that primordial fish, the fishes, the amphibians, the reptiles, and the birds. And my students are often surprised to discover that birds are descended from dinosaurs. So in many ways, the dinosaurs remain, they just remain in a different form. They're basically the birds. So if you look at there it is. So if you look at the view of life as we understand it today, this is a 3.8 billion year process on our planet. What you have is some primordial organism, often called LUCA, last universal common ancestor. We don't know very much about LUCA. And out of LUCA, you have an explosion of different life forms. You have the bacteria, the archaea, and the eukaryotes, and we are down here with the animals. I'm going to use this as the more robust vision of what happened. So this is the same picture that you saw in the previous slide, but now it's made into a circle. And so you have, at the very beginning here, you have the original life form, 3.8 billion years ago, and as time progresses, it moves out until you have this incredible diversity of living things. And the logo that we use for Thomistic evolution is actually Aquinas superimposed on this tree of life. So a lot of people don't realize that circle there is actually the logo for the tree of life. So how does evolution work? And this is probably the best thing. I'm just going to go into one particular example so you see. And we're going to talk about the evolution of the snake. And I'm going to present to you the data that we have for the evolution of the snake.
So just so you know, there are about 3,600 extant biological species of snake today. And they range from the Barbados thread snake, the smallest snake that we know, and this snake is completely and totally blind, to the green anaconda. This is actually a baby anaconda with a baby human. And it's huge. And so from a biological perspective, evolution seeks to explain where these organisms came from and how we got the diversity that we have today. Our best account is that snakes evolved from lizards. And so I'm going to go through the data for this claim. The evolutionary process takes about 100 million years, and the idea here is that snakes evolved from lizards that began to burrow into the soil. So you have a situation where a four-legged tetrapod, four-legged lizard, begins to burrow 100 million years later through a process of natural selection. You have a lizard, a snake coming out. And of course, for a lot of people, this looks like magic. And so what I'm going to have to do is go through some of the data for this claim. So I'm going to begin, so just to give you a sense, so from this perspective, a snake is a lizard that has lengthened its spinal column, lost its limbs, lost its left lung. Now, this is actually really, really interesting, because if you look at an embryonic snake at the very beginning of its life, it has two lungs. And then very quickly in the egg, the left lung disintegrates. It disintegrates through a process of suicide, cell death, which is what my students and I actually study in the lab. Now, it's always interesting because without an evolutionary account, it's hard to explain why this would happen. Why is it that you would have an embryonic snake with two lungs, which is presumably better than having one lung, and then you would actually have it basically explode at the early points in its life so that you only have one lung left. Now, it makes sense if you started off as a lizard and now you've got to fit all the different organs in your body into a long cylindrical shape. You actually have to try to minimize the stuff that's in your body. So what you do is you actually have a program that needs to be autodestruct of that left lung. The eyelids also fuse. So what's really striking is if you look at a snake can't blink at you. Because what happens is its eyelids have actually fused, and then the tissue over that have become transparent, so it actually looks through its fused eyelids. It also has acquired flexible jaws, which is why an anaconda can eat a deer. Okay? So, and the idea is that these changes initially took place to facilitate a life lived underground. Of course, since then, the snakes have come up and they have entered many, many different environmental niches. So what is the basis of the scientific claim? The first is fossils, and I actually brought a fossil.
Just because Aristotle said it's good for you to actually see and touch and feel everything that you're looking at. And a lot of people have never seen a fossil. They don't realize that a fossil is actually a rock in the shape of the organism that lived a long time ago. So I want to impress upon you that it takes an enormous amount of time to convert an organism into rock. Which is why for people who tell me that the world is 6,000 years old, I have to say, look at this. Look at this. Like, tell me, how can you do this in 6,000 years? You take a living thing, you, and I make that you into a rock. A rock that is incredibly detailed, that if you use the electron microscope on some of these fossils, you can see the microscopic structures of the eye of the organism. So this is a trilobite. I love trilobites. And one of the things is they lived for 200 million years. They're now extinct. Now, when you consider that they lived for 200 million years and we've only been around for about 100,000, they are a lot more successful than us. Now, of course, they will never see God. even though they're cool, humans are cool. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to pass this around for you to get a sense for this trilobite. So this is a fossil of a four-legged snake that was discovered in Brazil. So what you see is you've got the snake,
And then right at the very rear portion of the snake, you have the developed limbs. This is the only fossil that we have for a four-limbed snake. And this is an artist's rendition of what that snake would have looked like. It basically, the thought is that it used its incredibly small limbs in order to manipulate the prey so it would get a good hold on it as it tried to swallow it up. Now, we also have fossils of two-legged snakes. So here you've got the main body of the snake, and you see you have a visible leg. And the idea here is that you had a snake, if you notice, it's got hind limbs in this particular scenario. So that's the fossil record. But one of the striking things, too, is that we have lizards today that are alive that are snake-like in their body form. And this is really striking. Many people don't realize this. So if you look at the snakes, so the snakes are these green, this is indicated in this genealogy with the green symbol. It is surrounded by lizards of different forms and sizes, including limbless lizards. So let's look at a couple of them. So this is Larissa. You see it's elongated in its form, but it's got four limbs. Then this is another form of Larissa. It has rear limbs, but it doesn't have front limbs. It's already lost its front four limbs. This is Bakia. Bakia, you notice, has the four limbs, but doesn't have the hind limbs. And then what's really striking is you have limbless lizards. This is Pygopis, and this is a lizard. It is not a snake. And this is where we can get into philosophical discussions about how you distinguish these two different things. This organism can blink at you. Mm-hmm. All right? So from a biological perspective, the idea here is that this is a lizard because it has lizard abilities that snakes do not have. It also lacks snake-like abilities. So it cannot expand its jaws to eat things a lot larger than its mouth. But you notice here, again, you've got a limbless lizard.
Now, I'm a molecular biologist, so this suggests that transitional forms that move from lizards to snakes would have been viable because we already have them alive with us today. Now, I'm a molecular biologist, so I particularly like this part. This is the evidence from molecular and cellular biology. This is the data that begins to uncover the genetic changes that may have occurred to facilitate the lizard to snake transition. So in order for me to do this, I have to go over some basic developmental biology. These are the genes that regulate the body plan of most animals, including, for example, on the top, a fruit fly, a mouse, and humans. And the reason why a Nobel Prize was given for this discovery was because many of the congenital defects that babies have are actually attributable to genes that regulate the body plan of a fly or a mouse. These are the very famous Hox genes. And with these Hox genes, you can change body plans with a single genetic mutation. So here you have on the left, this is a wild type, this is a normal fly. And here on the right, we've been able to convert the antennae into legs by simply changing a single gene in the fly. You can do the same thing. What you have here is you've got a fly with a pair of wings. It has haltiers, and you can give it an extra set of wings. It's also got extra stomach inside. It's got a reproduction of an entire segment. So what you do is you take this segment and you duplicate it, and so it's got, this is the very famous,
So this is a very famous mutation. Now, we've even got it to the point that we've got PAX6, which regulates fly development. You may not realize it, but there you've transformed the antennae into an eye. And here, instead of legs, it's got eyes. And so we are able to genetically modify these organisms by simply changing a single gene. Now, I'm going to take this now back to the lizard-to-snake transition because we have begun to uncover the genes that do this. And so these are the Hox genes that regulate the tetrapod spine. So there's Hox 5, 6, 9, 10, and 11. And one of the things that I pointed out to you is that for a lizard to become a snake, you have to first extend its trunk. And so what people have done, if you look at this, if you compare a mouse on the left
and the snake on the right, we've been able to identify the genes that regulate the length of the thorax,
as well as the different kinds of vertebrae that you have in place. So for example, if you take the snake version of HOX10 and put it into a mouse,
what happens is it will lose its ribs. You see, so this is a normal mouse, and this is a mouse with a snake version of HOX10, and what you see is it's lost its ribs.
You can also do the same thing. You can take
HOX6, and you can induce extra ribs.
So we're now beginning to change the body plan. If you look at
the developing snake, and this is how it actually develops in its egg.
It has 300 vertebrae as compared to ours. We have 33, mice have 32.
One of the cool things, though, is that we've figured out which gene regulates the number of vertebrae.
So what we can do is we can take mice, and we can give them extra vertebrae.
And so what happens now is we're elongating the skeleton of the mouse and giving it snake-like properties.
So we're beginning to uncover the genetic circuitry that regulates this transition from lizards to snakes. Now, the second thing that lizards had to do was to lose their limbs in order to become snakes.
And we've begun to uncover this. This is Sonic Hedgehog, a very famous gene that regulates limb formation. And if you take that gene and you put the snake version into the mouse loses its legs. So you see here, this is a normal mouse. And what we can do is we can use genetic engineering, take the snake version, take the snake version, put it into the mouse, and what you have is a serpentized mouse.
And you have this situation.
So where you can actually see it, this is the normal mouse, here is a mutant mouse. It starts off with a little limb bud, but the limb bud disintegrates. Basically, you have a mouse that is not able to have any limbs. It has remnants of limbs.
And so what we've come to understand is that the evolution of snakes involves manipulations of these genes. And I'm sure there will be many, many genes.
But what I hope I've been able to convince you is we've been able to figure out the molecular parts that need to be altered in order to facilitate this lizard to snake transition.
So let's talk about...
Let's move to Aquinas now. So hopefully I just want to give you a sense of why we think the evolutionary account is actually robust and explains so much. The first thing I'd like to talk about is causality.
So, causality after Darwin. So we're going to begin with a Thomistic claim.
This is proportion of causality. It actually is a philosophical claim that makes sense from ordinary experience. The effect cannot be greater than the cause. You cannot give what you do not have. I cannot teach you Swahili because I can't speak Swahili. In fact, it would be very weird if I taught you Swahili if I don't know Swahili. It violates a fundamental philosophical account of the world in that way. You cannot give what you do not have.
Now, when does the lizard become a snake?
And there's many questions that can be raised by that. But from a basic biological perspective, when the offspring of two snake-like lizards are for the most part snakes, right?
So, and you can see, if you want to look at a mechanism, it'd be something like this. You have mutation.
So you have lizards extend their spine with an OCT4 mutation. They lose their rear legs. Sonic Hedgehog. Lizards lose their front legs. And then what they do is they start mating with each other. You've seen lizards are viable in these different forms. And eventually you get a snake. You also get the other versions, which we've been able to see.
So this is a standard account. It's a hypothetical model because it's hard to actually figure out what exactly happened. Now, this is the objection from the principle of proportional causality.
How can two lizards give their snake progeny a snake nature when they do not have it themselves? This is a standard philosophical objection.
And in fact, it was raised recently.
I don't know, you may or may not be aware that there is a concerted effort to undermine the Christian account, the Christian reconciliation with evolutionary theory. In the last year, two books were published. On the left, this is the Bible of the Intelligent Design Movement. It's an incredibly thick book. I'm still working my way through it. It raises scientific, philosophical, and theological critiques of evolutionary theory and the synthesis between Christianity and evolutionary theory. And this is a book written by our brother, Father Michael Szabrek from the province of Poland, who is a creationist, but he's a sophisticated creationist, and that his objections are primarily philosophical rather than theological. And so he and I have had numerous conversations, both in person and in print, and this is one of the things he wants to ask. He wants to ask, how can two lizards give rise to a snake when lizards don't have the snake nature that they can give to their kids? It's actually, from a philosophical perspective, it makes sense.
So I've written on this, and but one of the things that I've raised is that if you are concerned about this, you should be more
concerned about chemistry, because chemistry has this problem more fundamentally than biology. So people are concerned. Lizard plus lizard gives snake. This is bad, according to the philosophical account. But then look at this. This is hydrogen and oxygen gives rise to water. How can this happen? Right? So from a philosophical perspective, I point out to people that if you hold this against biology, you must also at the same time have problems with chemistry. Most people don't. They just assume that water is legit. So the philosophical principle is a sound one. You see, it's a sound one. So you can't get rid of the philosophical principle. What you have to do is you have to engage it and give an account of why this could be the case.
And so I have actually a manuscript that's being reviewed to talk about this right now. How do you talk about the causality of lizards and snakes using Thomas's basic principles? What you have to do is you first look at the causality of reproduction.
So this, what happens when two lizards get together to give a lizard to give rise to baby lizards? This is the account that we give. So the idea here is I'm going to apologize. I'm going to just go right through the philosophy. Some of this philosophy presupposes so much of the philosophy of nature and metaphysics of Aquinas. Nonetheless, I'm going to give you a sense of what we do. What we say is that these two lizards give their baby lizards the essence of lizard. They also give their baby lizard the prime matter associated with being a lizard. But it is God who gives the lizard its existence, its essence. We know, for those of you who are familiar with Thomas, this is a basic principle. You cannot give yourself existence, so you have to receive existence. And so in the causality of reproduction, we already have God playing a role, even when two lizards give rise to a third baby lizard. When you move to evolution, you have to tweak it a little bit. What you have to do now is the two lizards give prime matter, but what happens is God has to give not only the existence, but also the essence. It is God who actually fulfills the role of the more perfect being that gives rise to this snake, which has perfections that its parents do not have. Now, if you go back and look at Aquinas will attribute this kind of causality to the celestial spheres, because the best science of his day posited the existence of these perfect spheres that had some role in our world. But we have data that those spheres don't exist. So now what you have to do is you've got to replace that causality with a different causality. You can do it with angels. I know students who would prefer to do it with angels, but I'm going to go right to the big guy. And I'm going to say we can explain philosophically how this happens by attributing some kind of causality to God in the evolutionary process. This is actually not new. Jacques Maritain, in a 1967 paper on evolution, begins to posit this. He doesn't have the kind of biological tools that we have today and the biological concepts, but he's already going to do that. So this is one way of doing that.
So from a philosophical perspective, divine causality has an integral role to play in an account of the world of change.
In fact, not just in biology, in physics and in chemistry as well. And it is not God understood theologically as Father, Son, and Spirit. It is God understood philosophically as first cause.
going to move now to human nature. So there are issues that evolutionary theory raises with regards to the classical account of human nature. So there's a Thomistic claim, and actually not just Thomistic, it goes back to Aristotle. Organisms have an essential nature that explains their causal powers. That's just like a basic claim. This is essentialism. This is a moderate realism associated with the classical perennial philosophy. And the idea here is that every individual organism has a unique essence or nature that puts it into a natural kind. And you and I are human beings. We have a human nature. We take that for granted. However, and so here is a natural kind is defined by a genus and a specific difference. And the classic is the human organism is a rational animal. And now, however, if you go and do look at a modern biology text, or if you look at philosophers of biology who actually think about this, because most practicing biologists have no time to think about this, because you're writing grants all the time, is the idea is that today we define a biological species not by identifying a specific difference, a uniqueness that makes this thing what it is, but we basically list out a cluster of biological characteristics. And so, for example, the human organism, instead of being a rational animal, it is an organism with a light-built skeleton, large brain, reduced face, prominent chin, etc., etc. You just draw out the list, and if it fulfills that list, it's human. And if you know anything about the history of philosophy, at the end of the day, contemporary biologists are nominalists. Or conceptualists. There's an account here that it's convention and convention alone that specifies kinds. And so they're anti-essentialists and they deny the existence of natural kinds. Now, but natural kind talk, it plays a central role in theological, philosophical, and ethical discourse. For example, human beings have dignity. Incredibly fundamental claim presupposes that you can identify a human being. And so, especially in bioethics, where now I'm working in genetic engineering and the ethics of CRISPR gene editing, the question now we want to ask is there such a thing as a post-human? And there are a lot of people out there saying, if I change this, that you cease to be human, you now become either transhuman or post-human. And so there's a lot of philosophical baggage associated with whether or not you approach human nature as a nominalist or as an essentialist, as a realist. And so the question for me is, can we reclaim an essentialist account of human nature? Right? And so I am doing that by approaching this question. When did human beings first evolve? I want to talk about Adam. And this is actually, so I do a lot of Adam and Eve thinking, but and a lot of people assume it's theological for dogmatic reasons. The church has an account of this from the Council of Trent. Of course I do that, but for me it's primarily about recovering human nature so I can get to natural law.
So was Adam a historical individual? Now, if you presuppose a cluster theory of species, you cannot have a single individual that specifies the beginning of a species or a kind. I give you an example. What is the English language? So if I ask you, define the English language, what is the essence of the English language? You probably won't be able to do that. So what you will do is you'll give me a list of characteristics that separate English and, say, French or German.
But then if this is the case, it becomes incredibly hard to do this.
When did Middle English become Modern English? Because the transitions are very subtle.
Now, I've talked to Brother Jordan Zajac, who's our resident English professor, and he will say, it's Shakespeare. And the idea here is, okay, Shakespeare, it's an ad hoc account. You're just going to say, boom, we're going to define the beginning of modern English this way.
Now, we do this all the time. If I ask you, when does day become night? Right? Now, if you belong to the Jewish tradition, this is a really, really important question. because of the Sabbath, and they define night as the appearance of three stars. So if you can see three stars, it's night. Now, what's really striking for this is once you realize this, you go, oh, we have. It's very hard to specify a transition. Nonetheless, day is not night. Just because it's hard to figure out when it actually happens doesn't mean they're the same thing. A lot of people will say, oh, Father, that means snakes are lizards. I go, no. Just because it's hard to figure out when exactly a lizard becomes a snake doesn't mean that the lizard and the snake are identical.
Just like day and night are not identical, even though we struggle to figure out when it happens. So, how do we recover human nature? How do we recover Adam? This is the question that I've been working with, and this is a paper that just got published this month in the American Catholic Philosophical Quarterly, where I articulate the philosophical argument for why essentialism, moderate essentialism anyway, has more explanatory power than nominalism in explaining the causal powers of biological creatures. So as a biologist, I would say we assume essentialism is true. Even though we appear, when we define biological species to be nominalist, at heart I assume that my yeast cells and Saccharomyces cerevisiae from Russia that we will be getting next week will behave in the same way that same predictable way from the Saccharomyces cerevisiae with American passport is because, again, they have a common essence, they have a common nature that grounds them. And so what we have to do, and I've done this in several lectures, talking about how you specify a natural kind in our species, is to talk about rationality. So the classical tradition talks about human beings as rational animals. How do we look for rationality? I propose it is language, and Dr. Barr and I have been at many meetings on this. And the idea here is that it's the capacity for language that signals our rationality. Now, I'm currently working on a paper to make this claim. The capacity for language is inherently tied to the capacity for abstraction. This is a philosophical claim, but it's actually based on St. Thomas. So St. Thomas has this cool passage that I stumbled upon on the commentary in the Gospel of John. In the very first section, if you know the Gospel of John, it begins, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. And so he talks about the Word, and it's a philosophical reflection on language. And the philosophical reflection on the Word. And what he begins to say is at the end of the day, you need language in order to abstract, for the most part. There are a couple of things he says that you may not need it to, but for the most part, you have to. And it makes sense to me, and I'm working on this. For example, this is a phone, but it's also a gadget. It's also a thing. It's also a substance. So there are many, many different universals that you can predicate of this phone. In order for me to figure out which one of these things I'm going to use, I need to talk to myself. I need to go, which word am I going to use to refer to this when I'm thinking about it? And so Thomas, I think, gives us a clue to how we can talk about the symbolic, the nature of symbol and the nature of abstraction and how to relate that to contemporary accounts of language. And so this is...
Could you read that out loud?
Okay. For when I wish to conceive the notion of a stone, I must arrive at it by reasoning. And so it is in all other things that are understood by us, with the sole possible exception of the first principles, which since they are known in a simple manner, are known at once without any discourse of reason. Thus, in our mind, there is both the cogitation, meaning the discourse involved in investigation, and a word, which is formed according to a perfect contemplation of the truth. And the word here is ratio, it's concept. So what he's saying is you have to have discourse in order to get to a concept. But if you have to have discourse, you need to have language. You need to be able to talk to yourself.
So I'm proposing that we are rational animals because we are also speaking primates. You notice again, the primates is the genus and the speaking is the specific difference. So I'm kind of updating this, and I'm going to refer you to this cool book that we brought up in several meetings of the Society for Catholic Scientists, Berwick and Chomsky, Why Only Us and the Evolution of Language. And one model that I have proposed is to recover Adam is that within the original population of humans, one individual acquires a mutation that allows him to speak, and he speaks primarily to himself, right? So if you notice, you spend most of your time speaking to yourself, not to someone else. So the idea here, the biolinguistic account, is that language evolves not for you to speak to another, but so that you can articulate a conceptual view of the world.
And that God infused this individual person with the rational soul, because it's now apt for the rational soul. And since every single human being today can speak, every single human being had to have inherited that mutation, so we are all descended from this Adam. And so the conclusion here that I want to draw is that Homo sapiens, the biological species, is actually made up of two natural kinds, speaking and non-speaking. We belong to the speaking. And initially, in the initial evolution of our kind, there were actually two different kinds, the non-speaking and the speaking. The speaking were so highly adapted. They could cooperate to hunt for food. They could do things together that the non-speaking could not do. So in the course of natural selection, the speaking outcompetes the non-speaking. And today there are no non-speakers anymore.
So finally, and this is really short, this is virtue after Darwin. I'm not really written on this. This is the stuff I'm thinking about now, and I wanted to see what you guys thought about it. For those of you who know about Thomas's ethics and Thomas's moral account, you will see that this is his claim. Virtues habituate the inclinations found in human nature. This is the foundation of Thomas's account of morals, also the foundation of the Catholic Church's teaching on morals.
And the question I want to ask is, and these are the inclinations from the Summa, the preservation of human life, sexual intercourse, and the education of offspring, and the inclination to know the truth about God and to live in society. So these are the three basic inclinations that Thomas identifies in the human being. And I want to ask this question, what can we say about natural inclinations in light of evolutionary theory? Because you have to bring everything into conversation with evolutionary theory. And for this, I just finished reading this book on evolutionary psychology. So evolutionary psychology is a new paradigm in psychology that attempts to identify and to understand the human mind in light of its evolutionary adaptations. Now, what is really striking is that if you look at evolutionary psychology, they have identified these natural inclinations, towards acquiring food and water, securing shelter, acquiring a mate, bearing progeny, belonging to a group, and adaptive truth. There's a reason why I'm going to put adaptive truth there in a second. But these are inclinations, according to evolutionary psychology, that can actually be reconciled very easily with St. Thomas's account. However, what you also have is that there are other inclinations towards violence and aggression, inclination towards extra pair copulation. The word for this is called adultery. And there are reasons why extra pair copulations are highly adaptive for men, especially for males. Because then you sire many, many progeny. You only have this one female, and I've got 10. But then there's a way you've got to kind of manipulate the situation so that the one doesn't know about the other nine. So this is called extra pair copulation. I can tell you they still exist. I'm a priest. And then there's inclinations towards cognitive bias. And this is where adaptive truth. The idea here is that the intellect, from an evolutionary perspective, has evolved primarily to know the truth that is ordered towards your survival. So I just need to know what I need to survive. And so there's cognitive bias. What you tend to do is you believe people who belong to your group, and you disbelieve people who belong to the other. Because the idea here is that people who belong to your group are your friends, they will help you live. The others, they're probably trying to eat you. So what you have is you have these evolved adaptive traits that alter the way that the intellect encounters reality. So how do we take...
So what you have now is you go, how do we sort these out?
If you've got all these inclinations and you want to recover natural law, how do you bring it about?
And so what I have begun to do is, this is a paper that talks about, again, the fall of Homo sapiens and the historicity of the fall based on Thomas. And the argument here is we have to understand the fall in underweight, because the nature that evolutionary psychologists are looking at today is fallen human nature.
And once you see that, right, you're able to parse out
which inclinations are ordered to human excellence and which ones are not. And so here, I'm beginning to think through this. The idea is that our natural inclinations have to be ordered by reason according to our personal rather than to our animal nature. So extrapyramidal copulation might be great for a dog, but it's not great for a father. And the idea here is that we must, using our reason, we have to be able to distinguish between our lives as animals and our lives as persons. And this will allow us to parse out which inclinations are properly predicated of our nature and which are actually distortions of our nature because of the fall. So this is my overall conclusions, to conclude my talk. Hopefully you get a sense that evolutionary theory, there's great data for evolutionary theory. It can help us better understand God and his creation. And in other talks, I've talked about why would God have created this way rather than the way described in Genesis. Because my students are like, why? Why did he choose to do it? And Thomas provides wonderful reasons for that. Important mystic claims remain intelligible, but there's a lot of work to do to do more synthesis to integrate the two. So I'm a scientist, so I've got to end with thank you slides. So first of all, my laboratory. So this is my lab.
The neck in society, we kill yeast, billions of yeast all the time. So for the first 10 years of my lab, we focused primarily on cancer and how cancer cells don't die. And one of the reasons why they don't die is they've been able to find ways to get around the self-suicide program. So we're looking at the self-suicide program. But 6 months ago, we began work on modeling Parkinson's in yeast, and it was really cool to discover that Professor Meredith and I share a common interest. He's a physical biochemist, and I'm a molecular biologist, but we actually are looking at these protein aggregates. So these proteins accumulate abnormally in the brain, leading to numerous of these neurodegenerative diseases. He's looking at the aggregates, and we put the aggregates in yeast, and we're trying to figure out how these aggregates work in the cell. And that's really cool. We label them in different colors, green and red, to see whether they interact or not. But most important, these students ask me the hard questions. So late at night, it's 1 o'clock, you're running a gel. Father, why is there a devil? So we're doing DNA work, and why is there devil? So we start having a conversation about angels and demons. And it is they who ask me all these tough questions. It really is. They have an honest curiosity, and they don't have any of the biases. And they just want to know, it's Aristotle. They just want to know.
So this is my students, the Dead Yeast Society, and this is the funding that my lab gets. But I want to highlight, so we got money from the BioLogos Foundation, which is the foundation founded by Francis Collins, the director of the NIH, who is an evangelical Christian, to bring Christianity to dialogue with evolution. And all the work that my brothers and I have done with Mystic Evolution was funded by that money. And we're actually writing a Templeton grant this summer. The project is going to be Aquinas after Darwin to deal with some of the questions that I've raised. We want to try to build it up. Thank you so very much for your kind attention.
Everything you said makes a whole lot of sense, but what I don't understand is why is it not possible for there to be some kind of middle ground between like where there was some kind of special creation and then there was descent after that? Like, is that possible or
So the humans, so if you if
I'm going to make a couple of distinctions. If you mean the following, special creation is a direct intervention in the natural order by God. If you say, were there moments in historical time where we should think about that kind of intervention, absolutely. Every human being comes to be in a process that requires the direct intervention of God. So you, in one sense, you are specially created. So the way that the church and sound philosophy thinks about this is that the matter that you have is descended from an evolutionary process, but the spirit that you are, because we are matter-spirit composites, is a direct gift from God. So in that sense, it's both. Now, so the question you need to ask me actually is, why did God choose to create through a 3.8 billion year process involving gradual change rather than intervene directly into his creation in the way that Genesis applies? And the account that I found, the answer I find most convincing is from Aquinas. Actually, Aquinas will say the following. He will say, why did God make many things rather than one thing? And Aquinas will say, well, that's because the things that he made in order to reflect himself. And since he can be reflected in an infinite number of ways, the more things he makes, the more fitting it is because those things reflect him. And the way I explain this in my class is, if you wanted to study a painter, it is better for you to have a gallery of his works rather than one picture. Because the gallery better represents all the individual paintings will represent different aspects of him. Now, if you look at special creation, if you ask how many species do we have today on the planet, it's about 8.7 million. If you ask over the course of 3.8 billion years how many species have ever lived, it's on the order of 6 or 7 billion. So the idea is that by creating through an evolutionary process, he could produce many, many more paintings for a very small gallery, which is our planet, right? And some of those paintings can't be exhibited at the same time in the gallery. You cannot have a T-Rex and an elephant at the same time, because the T-Rex will destroy the elephant. So what you want to do then is you make sure that the T-Rex appeared yesterday, the elephant appears today, and then in your creation, you can have so many paintings. Hopefully that makes sense to you.
So going back to the problem of proportionate causality, the account you gave was that from like two lizards, for example, they provide the prime matter, and then God would provide not only that existence, but also the essence, and then you lead to the form of the snake. The difficulty I have with that is that like prime matter is pure potency, right? So theoretically, it could receive any form. But in evolution, we see that there is a very specific type of form that a thing is able to receive. So like a squirrel doesn't come from lizards, but a snake does. And that's normal. The other one would be odd. So I wonder if instead of thinking about it in terms of two things providing prime matter for its descendant, if it would be better to think about it in terms of more like a specified matter that's capable of receiving a certain form but not other forms. And so thinking about it, like the lizards virtually contain the form of the snake, but not other things.
So in the details of it, what I'm going to say basically is that this prime matter is coming from lizard. So it's not just generic prime matter, it's already a lizard that is limited by, it's prime matter limited by the lizard form of the parents. So the idea here is that it's just like, you know, human beings that die don't become butterflies.
Right.
And the reason is that the form of human being at death limits the substantial transformations that can possibly occur. So the idea is that the two lizard parents actually limit the substantial change, but to snake, can't become a kangaroo. However, what happens is that immediate transformation still involves perfections that lizards don't have. So it is the Lord who has to reduce the new form from the matter, right, as well as provide the essay in order for that lizard to come to be.
But I wonder if the scientific data we have stretches that philosophical principle too far to where like if we have to invoke that, that God is the one who provides the form.
Well, I mean, we have to say that even in all the chemical reactions, right? So it's not an either or. It's not like God or the sp3 orbitals that generate the different things in chemistry. It's both. It's looking at two different aspects of reality. Are you looking at the causal, the underlying metaphysical structure that, that explains the causal changes? Or are you actually talking about the changes in the substances themselves? Both are true. So in this case, what would happen is these lizards would undergo mutation, and mutation is a change in the predisposition of matter for form. At some point, a mutation arises that when you combine the gametes, so the egg and the sperm, the combination of mutations is such that the disposition of this matter, which should have been for lizard form, is now for snake form because of these mutations. But properly speaking, because the snake form is novel with regards to the lizard form, the lizard itself can't give to its progeny. So it is divine causality that needs to induce that form from that matter. So, so you bring in mutations, you bring in everything. It's just that to explain the metaphysics of it, you have to talk about other forms of causality.